Welcome to the Starting SaaS Podcast. Starting a career in SaaS can be intimidating. I've been there, but it doesn't have to be. From the basics to the latest trends, this podcast will help you build a foundation and stay ahead of the curve. This is the easiest way to learn about SaaS from the folks inside of it. Welcome to the Starting SaaS Podcast. Today, I'm more than excited to welcome onto the podcast Phil Alves. Phil is the CEO and principal consultant at DevSquad. DevSquad is an agency that helps you take your digital project from ideation to launch and beyond. With DevSquad, he's led the build of over 100 SaaS products from bootstrapped founders all the way to VC-funded startups. And today, I'm so excited because we actually got into tons of different topics. Why you shouldn't start a SaaS as your first business, nice to have versus need to have products. How do you almost unlock in order to make sure that your product finds the market that it best suits, whether or not you should build your product for scalability, and why you should actually solve the boring problems. This was a phenomenal episode, probably one of my favorites in that it helped you really think like a CEO and problem solver. Let's get it. Well, anyways, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's jump straight into your origin story. Did you know what SaaS was whenever you first got into it, or did you find it?
No, I didn't. So I built a product and I wrote about it on my blog, and it was not like a product. I wrote a custom software for someone. And then people found that on Google and they start asking me to, that they want the same thing. And the first thing I did, actually, I would send up a server for each of the customers. And then eventually I had like 8 people using the same software, the same custom thing that I built. And then one person would complain of a bug and I had to go fix everywhere else because each one of them had their own installation of that product. And then I was like, there's got to be a better way. How can I do this so like it's one application that everyone uses? And when I do an update, everyone receives the update. If I build a feature for X, I don't have to copy and paste it for everyone else. Like a person requests a feature and I'll build it. And then I will copy and paste for all the other customers. Or worse, I wouldn't do it. So like in a couple of months, I have the same product that look very different for everybody. So that's how I learned about SaaS and ended up building my first SaaS product.
Okay, so you stumbled into it. It was like I'm creating my own product, and instead of creating one thing that everybody can go to and use, I'm creating individualized like products. So you're creating almost a single product for every single individual. And so you were like, well, how do I do this better? And did you just fall into SaaS or?
Yes. Kind of like that. Yeah, but it was not even like I'm building a product because I want to build this product. It was I wrote a custom solution for someone that I happen to own the code for. And then everyone want that same custom solution to solve the same kind of problem. So it was a total accident. I just wrote on my blog, hey, I just wrote this thing that pays commission. And this is how it works. So it wasn't like, it was a total accident. I wasn't even thinking about, I want to build a product for X. It's just like, hey, yes, the person paid me for, let me build whatever they want.
You had a background in coding.
Yes.
Okay, that's so cool. And did you self-teach or was that something you went to school for?
No, I was young when I started. I was like probably 16, 17. So I learned in books. Yeah. So but it was back in the day, like I'm dating myself here, but we didn't have so much videos on the internet and online courses. So I actually just bought books and learned how to code in PHP from books.
Wow. Okay. So then once you learned how to code, you were building websites and products and all kinds of different things. And then you had this blog where you posted the different things that you were doing and then people ended up finding you.
Yeah. So like my blog, actually, I would write things that I was learning there. I didn't know, but I was doing SEO at the time. So I didn't know. So what happened, it was like I was learning to code and then I would be going in other sites and I asked if I could submit an article to those sites because like I want to be one of the authors. And so I couple sites would say yes, and then I start publishing different tutorials on how to do certain things in coding, and every single thing that I would post in big sites, they would have a link back to my blog. So I was doing link building, and I also didn't know that I was doing link building. And then that's why when I wrote that one post in my blog and I put the right title, which also wasn't planned, I start ranking for the keywords for people that were trying to pay commission, and they need the software to do it. So it was 100% by accident.
That's so incredible. So like, for anybody that doesn't know, the way that Google ranks is there are a couple of different things, but there's a thing called, crawling. And so Google has a bot that goes across all of the websites and it crawls and it tries to understand, okay, what are all of the websites in existence? And it wants to give you the best information possible. So then what it does is it looks at the links that are going back to it, and that is a sign of authority. So like that's so interesting that you unintentionally were creating all of this authority for your blog and your website. And it was just like was it just something that you were like, okay, this makes sense? Or why did you do it?
I just had this desire to learn and teach. And I had nothing. I wasn't thinking. I was, again, very young. And it was easier back then, too. Like, this is 2008, 2007. So Google didn't have all the updates. And there was, like, wasn't so much competition on Google. And I was also in Brazil, where, like, there's even less competition at the time on Google. So, yeah, that I wasn't planning. It was just I was moving and I was working. And that's how I got the first...
Sometimes finding or following your passion and following the thing that just feels right does work out pretty well.
Yes, it does.
Okay, so after this, your first SaaS ever, how did you get to where you are now with DevSquad?
So I actually ended up selling the SaaS, and that was enough money for me not to work for a few years and to move from Brazil to United States. It wasn't a lot of money because, like, students don't spend a lot of money, but I figure I can live like on this budget and I can go to school in the United States. And I was like 22 at the time. And so that's what I ended up doing. I moved here, went to school here. I didn't have to work for a few years. So that's what I did. But eventually I got a job as a developer, got a job as a CTO. And I realized there was a huge demand for, developers that understand beyond writing code, people that could think about product, that would understand the whole life cycle, and that could help people actually create products. And that's when I was like, oh, I know a lot of developers in Brazil. I have the experience of actually building different kind of products. I'm going to start my own development agents. And so about 2015, I quit my job and then I start DevSquad.
Interesting. So you mentioned that you went from having a job as a coder to then being a CTO. That's a really big leap. How did you manage that?
Well, so I was just like, there's not enough company. And they're like, hey, we have this team. We have like 8 developers. And you were doing a very good job as a developer. And you can communicate well. So here, now you lead this team. You're the CTO. So that's kind of like, and then also was leading that team that I learned that many times when you hire developers don't have what I call product level thinking. They just think, what's the next task I have to do? Oh, okay, tell me what to do and I'm going to do it. But I was like, hey, I'm leading this team of developers and I just don't want to tell them what to do it. I want them to help me think and to work together. And I don't want to be making all those decisions all by myself. And I don't know all the answers. So that's kind of like, it's what really makes DevSquad different is I want to build a company that think. And that's kind of like why I started DevSquad.
Interesting. Okay, so you mentioned that you wanted developers that had product level thinking. So why, number one, why is that so important? Number two, why did you have that? Like, what in your history made it so that you were thinking about the product from this like expansive perspective? You were looking at the whole product and not just, okay, what do I have to do right now today?
I guess it's very important that developers think about the whole product, because now you have a team and they see things that maybe you're not able to see. It's not so much work for you as a leader, because you don't have to be like telling step by step. You don't have to micromanage. And so it's kind of like the task level thinking. What's my next task? And the product level thinking. What problem are we solving? Moving here, I kept working as freelancer, so I built a couple products for other people, even when I have my job. At my job, I work on a product, and I start learning more about product and reading books, and learning more about product management. And that's when I realized that's like kind of like the missing link of people that only think about task. And that's where we could add a lot of value. So that's kind of like where we start Dev Squad, and we specialize in building SaaS products, and we bring the product level thinking for our customers.
Whenever you hire people for Dev Squad, are they already pretty well versed as product level thinkers, or do you have to teach that?
It's a little bit of both. There's a lot of things, because we want them to have some of that knowledge and to think big picture. But there's also a lot of trainings that we do inside, because maybe people work in a place where they weren't expected to think. They just want to receive a task and get the task done. And it's funny, because now, like with AI and everything, doing the task is getting easier and easier. Like, it's thinking that's getting harder. I think writing code, it's going to keep becoming easy, but creating products is going to get harder, because when you're creating a product, we just have so many options. What is the last time that you adopt a new product in your personal life? You know, like, you don't need one more product. You already have too many things going on. So build products going to get harder. Write code is going to get easier. So you want people that think about the product and how we solve real problems.
Okay, so that's really fascinating to me, because I've been looking at all of the changes in AI and all of the changes that it I guess incites for different industries and role types specifically, and the whole notion that it's going to make coding easier but building products harder, I think that's spot on. What do you see as kind of those core skills that make building products so important, or like what are good product builders? What kind of skills do they have?
It's funny, because creating a product or creating a business, at the end of the day, is always about making bets. Great product builder is what I see even in my own firm. There are someone that have a huge industry knowledge. They understand the problem very well. So they can place bets that are more likely to win. They put the odds in their favor. And on top of that, they're willing to listen to their users, but to a point, because you don't want your users to give you a solution. You want them to give you a problem. And with the problem, you create the solution. And you can only create the solution if you understand that problem very well. So I believe being an industry expert helps a lot. Not all product people are industry expert, but you can become an industry expert and then care about, are people really using your product? How can we track? What is the next thing that we can do?
How do you think about getting to like that underlying problem? So like, users will give you 10 problems, right? And there's usually a couple of underlying fundamental problems that are the real causes of your user's pain.
Yeah, it's very complex. I think it comes with time. It comes with like, it's about making bets. And the more bets you make, the better you become. You don't have to be right all the time. and it's your knowledge of, I have done this enough and this is what's going to work. And many times, like, you have to be a contrarian. You have to think different. And yeah, it's what's important to be a build a successful product many times, you know.
With Dev Squad, y'all are taking the ideas that people have and making them a reality, correct?
Mm-hmm.
What is that like? Because I'd assume that people are bringing you a lot of ideas that are either not fully fleshed out or that are big and lofty, and they they want all of these things for their product. They're like, this is how it needs to happen. This is how it needs to be. And is it does it occur that, you know, whenever people are asking for these things, sometimes they're unrealistic in their expectations?
Oh, yeah. But that's a part of the value that we add. Because we don't listen to them and do what they tell us, we're going to talk. We're going to understand. We're going to think, like, look, there's different stages of building a product. You're going to get to private beta. You're going to get to users in. And then it might take a long time to actually find product market fit, meaning your people actually use. And then we try to work with those people so they understand how can we make a plan to get where you want to get. And you bring the vision, but what else do you bring besides the vision? Do you really understand the industry? Do you understand what you're trying to accomplish? And so we end up not taking everyone as a customer because we have this specific person. But the first thing that we do is try to plan the next 90 days and what success looks like. And we go into OKRs. And I know I might be throwing up a lot of terms here. People might not understand, but, we get that what those are. But it's about planning. And really helping these people plan so we can take a product, to market, in a time that makes sense.
I like that. OKRs are objective key results, and they're basically there's a way of tracking and making sure that you're staying on target with your progress. So how do you view the like good OKR setting? I know that everybody has some personal ideals for like how they like to set OKRs, but in product, is there any gold standard for setting OKRs?
I think they're very flexible, but at the end of the day, we want to make sure that there are something that you can track. The key results, they have to be trackable. You have to be able to get there in the next 90 days or a year, depending how you're setting your OKRs. But what I love about OKRs, it's like we have to put how are we going to know if you were successful? And then from there, we can think about features, because sometimes people start thinking about features first. I need this, 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 and this. I'm like, wait. What problem are you trying to solve? Oh, I want to make I want to help CPAs make more money. Cool. So how are we going to do that? So if that's the track, what if you can just help CPAs make this much more money? You can bring this much CPA. So you start thinking about the problem first and the key results that's going to help you solve that problem. And then you go down and think about features that's going to affect those metrics and not the other way around. That's why I like to start with OKRs when you're building a product, because you're helping. Okay, this is the objective. This is where we're trying to get. So it's a great framework.
I like that. And then whenever you're building your betas, are you taking like a minimum viable approach? Like you want to build the smallest thing possible that you can put out into market to see if it resonates with the market they're trying to serve?
Yes, for sure. You have to, you don't want, the longer you build something that nobody's using, the higher is your risk that you're going to really fail. You know, so one thing that I like to say, sometimes we need to build a tool before we build a platform. So let's say my own SaaS, it's to help development teams become high performing, because I have more than 100 developers on my team, and I want to make sure we can track developers, help them get better, improve processes, remove roadblocks. But like before we build this whole software, what is one tool that we can build that could add value right away? So we build a benchmark. The benchmark feature, we look at the DORA metrics, which is research done by Google of the metrics that your developers should be tracking and where they should be to be considered a high-performing development team. And then we just did this one thing, was just a benchmark. My vision, it is that's going to do 100 more things, but like, can I give this tool to tell people where they are and then move it forward from there? So, yeah, you really have to think, what is the smallest thing that I can do that's going to add value, even if it doesn't solve the whole thing that I'm trying to solve yet?
As an agency owner, how do you deal with customers that are unhappy?
So we really try to, when I think the problem with clients are unhappy if they're not the right fit for you, right? So we do the best we can to be transparent when we're speaking with customers and to identify if they're the perfect fit for us. Because if our onboarding customers that are the right fit, they're going to be happy. Like, for example, one of the biggest red flags for us is someone that never had any business before and they want to start with a SaaS, you know, so they might not have the right experience, the right time, the right money to do it. So we just look at many things and we talk about from the beginning, that's a two-way street. We want to be a great fit for them and we want them to be a great fit for us. So if they're unhappy because we dropped the ball, we have to fix it. If they're unhappy because they're unreasonable, then we have to part ways because they're not a good fit for each other. But we are usually able to identify that in the initial conversation. We don't even have to start working together anymore. Of course, it happens. Okay, well, we got the wrong customer. But then my team knows, hey, look, you accept this customer. What's wrong? We have to fire this customer. That's what we do. That's how we keep a culture of working only if the customers that we can add the most value and they're happier with what we are providing to them.
I've heard of that term, firing your customer, and I actually think that that's, like, I respect the fact that y'all take that approach because nothing is more important than making sure that your key your team is strong and that the culture is what you want it to be. And obviously, sometimes customers can get in the way of that if they're not the right fit.
For sure. And that works even in SaaS products. Like we have built a SaaS product for a person. And the person that's signed up and using the product is not their ideal customer. It's not their ISP. Now he's requesting a bunch of features. He's complaining that doesn't work. And like, you just have to say, hey, I'm not building this for you. I'm building this for X. Thank you for coming here. Because like, when you start to serve too many, ICPs, you get in trouble. But in services, it's easier to do that than in product because in service, you can just, yes, just pay us. We're going to do it. And then you start to customize everything. And then you have a company that's not scalable. The reason why DevSquad grew to almost 100 people, it's because we follow the same process with every single customer. And our customers, they're trying to solve this same problem and then they value the way that we work.
I like that. So it's funny because everybody, and I've heard this way too many times, people are always like, I want to start an app or like, I have an idea for an app. And everybody has an idea for a SaaS or for some sort of a product. But you just mentioned that nobody or you don't recommend that people start with SaaS. Why is that?
SaaS is high risk, high reward. I think any kind of business, it goes back to what we're talking about. It's about placing your bet and trying to win or not. Like you might be wrong or you might be right. But when you're placing a bet in a SaaS, it's a huge bet. Usually you're going to lose money for 2 to 3 years. That's why there's so much VC money involved. Because things move so fast. Let's say even if you manage to raise millions of dollars in money, now things are going to move fast because the investor is going to pressure you. If you're trying to bootstrap, how are you going to bootstrap if you didn't have a business before where you can get money from? So it's not that it's impossible, but I really think you put the odds against you. And I'm personally, I like to put the odds in my favor. and even when I look at our customers, people that are very successful, building SaaS products that they took to 8 figures, it wasn't their first product or their first company. Maybe they had a retail company before. Maybe they had a service company before. And then they move into that because now you understand how to hire. You understand culture, understand cash flow. You understand depreciation. You understand, net profit, gross profit, EBITDA. If you don't know any of those things, don't get into SaaS. I know a lot of terms there because then into SaaS, you have to get into churn, MMR, AAR, product market fit. It's a complex business where you have to be a savvy entrepreneur to pull it off. And a lot of SaaS entrepreneurs fail. Just again, you're making a bet. And what kind of bets do you want to place? You want to place bets that are more likely to win or more likely to lose?
I have a mentor who always says, play games that you're uniquely positioned to win.
And I think, exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And it all starts with the idea, though. So like, you have an idea, and you mentioned a little bit of why it's so important that you work in an industry where you're going to serve, right? So like placing a bet, playing a game that you're uniquely positioned to win is choosing an idea or betting on a product where you know the problem. Like, you've either experienced the problem or you have been around people that are complaining day in and day out about the problem. You know the industry. You know people in the industry who can help you, you know, distribute, et cetera. And it's like, I've seen a couple of people that have built SaaS tools, and whenever they try to build something for an audience that is not either them or is not somebody they know very, very intimately, it's a lot harder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, you don't know where to find these people. If you know where to find, like, we had this one customer, she built a product for people in her industry. She just went to a couple of conferences. She started showing the product. She speaks the same language. And in like 2 years, she's making seven figures, and she ended up actually selling the first business that she had before, building the actual product that she built. Yeah, you really need to understand the industry and where people are, what they do, how they do. Now, we have worked with successful people. Maybe they were like head of sales in a big organization, and now they're building products for salespeople. They never actually run their business before. But even though I would start with a consulting, this is how I help salespeople do better. And then create a consulting, creating a service around, get money in, and see how your ideas work. And then you turn your consulting into a product later. And also that allows you to be able to do the route that's bootstrap. Of course, raising money, it's amazing, but it's just a reality that most people are not going to be able to raise money if you don't know the right people, if you don't have the right resume, if you didn't start a career at the right big companies. So I would still start service offer, understand the market, consult it, and then go down and build a product. If you think, is a strategy that I build on my own product? I run a company, and then my whole purpose of my company is to deliver people high-performing development teams. And now I have a software that helps people build high-performing development teams. So I'm solving the same problem with my service and with my product. Of course, with my product, it's going to be at a much, much higher scale. But I can't afford to lose money for 2-3 years with my product now, because I have a profitable service business funding that venture.
Yeah, I like that. That's interesting. I have a question for you about that. But before I get into that, have you seen it as harder to build a product right now with the economy as it is?
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. Because before it was so easy to raise money, to get money from investors, and also companies were buying a lot of SaaS products. Now they're like, what can we cancel? Because we're spending a lot of money. But that's funny, because I know this guy, and he built a SaaS product to help you make sure your SaaS bill is not too high. And he's killing. So yeah, it all depends about what problem you're trying to solve. But the economy is definitely affecting capital and how companies are acting in this market.
Interesting. So then the other question I was going to ask about was services versus partners, or products, actually. I've heard that it's actually infinitely harder to build a service than it is to build a product. So are you basically saying, like, go into the service, take the huge challenge, because then whenever you come out of it, you'll not only have that, cushion for, you know, revenue and money just in case?
So it's very, very hard to scale a service business. It to get a service business from 2-3 people to 100 people is ridiculous hard. It's even harder than scaling a product. That being said, to get a consulting gig and make $10,000 a month, $15,000 a month, that's not hard. And that gets you in the industry. That gets you in the knowledge that you need to get. And there's multiple products that start that way. You think about companies like Basecamp. They start with a service business. There's people that I brought on my podcast that start as a service business. So it's a good way to start. It's impossible to scale, but there's no way to lose money in service too. Like, cause I'm getting paid for the work I'm doing. So if I'm going to charge $100 an hour, $200 an hour, $300 an hour, whatever, I'm going to always be profitable if I'm small. So I'm not saying go scale a service business. Actually, I did that. It's How hard? Don't do that. But but it's a quick way to get into industry and understand it. So I don't think a small service business is a hard business to run and to build.
So if you decide to take that route, right, like you decide to start a service industry or a service, either consultancy or some sort of a, I don't know, like an agency or something service related, what are the right questions that you should be asking if you are trying to eventually go and run a SaaS, if you're trying to go and build a product from this? What are you? What should you be focusing on? Just the problems that people are facing, the struggles?
Yeah, like you... What's the problem that I'm solving, but how can I understand and make these people's life better with a product, not just doing the work for them? Like what can be scaled and can be converted into a product? Like, let's say you are a sales consultant and you are coming into organizations and you're helping them with behavior change and how they should think. And you're like, okay, how can I translate this things that I'm teaching people into a piece of software that's going to change the same behaviors and that's going to achieve the same output that I'm able to do when I'm talking to these people.
Interesting. So the funny thing with products is that everybody thinks that their product is a need to have, but as we're seeing with the, you know, the economy and the fact that everybody's canceling all types of service, all types of tech products, I guess, most products are nice to haves, not need to haves, especially right now. If you're going to build a SaaS product, it's better to build a need to have than a nice to have. How do you know if it's a need to have versus a nice to have?
It's very hard, even because like the first version of your product, it might not be still a need to have yet, right? But you have to think about how big is the pain I'm solving. But that's another reason why SaaS is so complex. People say, hey, build MVP. It's going to take 3 months. Great. But how long is it going to take for you to get to PMF, product market fit? That's when your product really click. That's when if you take your product out of someone's life, they're going to hate. For example, Notion. It's probably the last product that I adopted. Like if you think of, because we don't actually adopt a lot of new products. We see them, we stop using. And now if you take Notion from me, I'm going to be like, oh my gosh, my life is so much harder because I build this thing into my systems and into how I act. And there's a lot of companies that they had product market fit when the economy was hot and people were buying everything. And they realize now that they don't have product market fit, that people are not using their product, that people don't want the product. So build a product is fast. Find a product market fit, it takes a long time and it's hard. That's why, again, SaaS lose money for so long. And there's nothing that you can do other than keep testing, they keep trying, they keep understanding your users, keep building different things, keep iterating until you find that thing. But it's just, it isn't quick. It's complex, you know? But the better you know the industry, the higher chance is going to be to get there quicker.
Yeah, I've thought about this quite a bit because, first off, it's half about finding product market fit, right? So like finding how you can make sure that you're solving the right problems, and then it's half communicating that. So like finding those watering holes, making sure that you're communicating to the right people, hey, here's the problem that we're solving, this is how we're solving it. And that communication piece has always been really interesting to me because communication is, in my opinion, threefold. It's text-based, it's image-based, and it's speaking. So it's like the whole company, right? So like mm-hmm. every single thing that you're putting out to market. And that's really fascinating to me. How have you seen, I guess, good product managers and the people that are building the product internally position a product well so that it lands with their market? Like if you have a great product and it's like literally the perfect product, but you don't communicate it right, like that's off. Product market fit is off.
Yes, for sure. And that's another piece. Like you really have to understand communication, CRO, conversion rate optimization, what's the right messaging. But I think, and I saw that many times before, maybe people build a product for one person and they realize that whoever is going to have the biggest value is the other person. So there's a lot of try and error too. Like I seen like, okay, here's our user base and let's understand who they are. And this is the different people that are using your product. Who's our power users? Why these people are power users? And can we get more of them? I guess that's a long way of saying that it's a lot of really getting to the weeds and trying and testing. And then you have to test messaging with product and who's the right person? Is the pain big enough for that person? Is a need? Is a want? So it's a long game to play, but yeah, good product managers, they have to think, work together with marketing and with everybody to say the right, get the message correctly and communicate that correctly.
If you were to get tactical, what are the day-to-day actions that good product managers are doing in order to find and discover that product market fit?
So the data that I like to track the most, it's how many weeks in a row it's the user coming back to my product. Like the user's trick. I want the user to be back here 8 weeks in the row and then they're actually using it. Think about it exclusively about B2B SaaS products. Or do they have to be here every day? But we have to look at engagement. The engagement metrics are the metrics that I like to look at the most. There's like the famous Facebook example, like if you add 7 friends, then you got your aha moment. But I believe in B2B products, it's more like, are people coming back and they're usually using this every day or every week or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. And that would depend on the product specifically. So like if it's Notion, if you're using it every day or multiple times a week, then that's good. If you're using it one time a week, then I'd probably say, I'm not sure how integrated into your life it is.
Yeah. And then you extrapolate from that. Look, there's this group of people that are actually using every day or every week. Who are they? Can you get more of those? And if those people are not using, hey, marketing, let's stop selling for X and Y because they don't actually use this product.
What do you tell SaaS founders or owners that think everybody uses their product or like everybody, my market is everybody?
Well, that's a good indication that they don't understand their marketing well enough and they have to go back to the drawing board and think like, really, who are you going to serve? Everybody and nobody, it's exactly the same thing. Right? So we really should go deep and we have to understand who those users are.
Is it that also at the very beginning, whenever you don't have your product completely fleshed out, your product could potentially serve multiple, not just industries, but multiple, I guess, ICPs, like multiple customer profiles, multiple personas. And then as you flesh out your product and you're like, okay, this is the direction we're going to go, you get deeper into that one ICP. Have you seen that ever where like it could potentially be multiple?
Yeah. So there is, I like to say, the horizontal play and the vertical play. And now the big players, they're actually playing the horizontal. Like think Salesforce. They are not CRM for car dealerships, or they are a CRM. But I believe the right strategy is to start on a vertical and then go horizontal from there. And then also I see people that start on the horizontal by accident and then they have to figure out what's the vertical that works. Go deep on that vertical and then go back to the horizontal. But that's the thinking, like you always have to start with a vertical.
And then I took a product management course for a while because I thought that I wanted to go into product. Product's always been so fascinating to me because I actually think that product is kind of how, like if you boil a whole business down, it's pretty much product. Like product is how it works. Like it's, you start, you build, you research, like that is the business pretty much. And so it's always been fascinating to me because it added context into everything else that I was doing, whether, you know, I was in marketing or whether I was, you know, trying to understand sales or partnerships, like something about understanding product makes you understand your whole business better. So I think everybody needs to understand product. But recently there was a pretty big, it was like a trend, and it's been a trend for a while to build your product into a platform, right? Because then platforms are easier to scale and they have better scalability. Do you ever tell people not to do that?
I think you have to do that at the right time. You know, it's like people want to look at a product today and they want to copy what they're doing today. When you should look at the product today and think, what have you done in the beginning that allow you to even get in the route to be where you are today? So what I like to say is build a tool before you build a platform. And you might never want you have to build a platform and think about how much money the companies that actually building platform raise. Like, do you have that kind of money, that kind of resources? And if you do, great. But like, even those, like, if you think about, like, let's think Facebook is a B2C everyone uses. It starts as a Harvard thing that was only for the Harvard people. You know, it starts, and then Ivy Leagues, and then extended, and then everyone uses. Or if you think about the product, the companies that have a suite of products, like now Salesforce went and bought Slack, and they keep adding things. But when they really start, if you could go back and look at Salesforce, what was that one problem they were trying to solve? They didn't start this big platform. They didn't start buying a bunch of products, you know? So that's how we should think about it.
Do you ever think about building scalability into your product, though? So, like, building it so that it can be scalable. I've only seen either seasoned professionals understand that, or, like, have the longevity to be like, okay, these, if you know your product, you know your industry, you know your product market fit, because you know what you're building, then it's easier to do that. But then, or at least that would be my assumption.
So less than 0.5% of SaaS products make over $10 million in revenue. And I think over-optimizing, over-engineering, thinking about the future in the beginning is actually a mistake that a lot of people do. Like, do you even have a user? Do you even have 100 users? So I'm not too worried about that. The way that I think about it, it's like, use best practices. We use test-driven development. Because if I need to change this dramatically, my test is going to tell you if I broke something. But I'm not too worried in the beginning, this is going to have millions and millions and millions of users. I think we all make the mistake of thinking that we are outliers. We can all be outliers, you know? And also, another thing that in the last few years, everyone wants to build $100 million SaaS. You know, can you just build like a $10 million SaaS and be happy? Like, that's where a lot of SaaS products are anyways. And they raise a bunch of money and they fail to get to that 100 million. And then they become a failure. You know, in the book Lost and Founder from Rand Fishkin, he talks about how he grew Moss to $50 million in revenue. And that was a totally failure because for whatever reason, they were trying to build a company that would make hundreds and hundreds of millions in revenue. So, I wouldn't start trying to build something huge. I believe you have to make 1 million before you make 10 and then just go that route and then start to worry about scalability problems when you get there. You know, like, don't solve problems you don't have yet. That's how I think.
What do you think are people's goals? Like, what are, I guess, to answer that question, I guess, and then to ask you another question, it seems as though things have changed, right? So, like, I forget where I heard this, but there was a survey done where they asked, how much money do you want to make? And, like, everybody's at the, you know, one million. I need to make $1 million. And it used to be that, oh, like, my goal is $100,000. My goal is, you know, $200,000. And for some reason, maybe it probably has to do with all of these shiny objects and the fact that we all have, you know, smartphones that allow us to connect with all these people that are doing cool things. But it's like, we all have these lofty goals, you know, 1 million, 10 million, even 50 million from a SaaS isn't enough for people, it seems. And everybody wants to hit that $100 million range. But what does that say about our goals?
I think the problem is not our goals, but how we go about our goals. It's trying to start at the end. Because if we look, let's say, Elon Musk, first he built a small company and he sold that company for $30 million. Then he built another company and then he sold that company, which was PayPal. And then he put out his, so like, there's a step. Like, if you look at any successful entrepreneur, they didn't start there. Like, or maybe there's the outliers of the outliers. So, I believe there's no problem in like, you know, say, hey, I want to be a billionaire, but you have to think that before I can get there, I have to figure out how I'm going to make 100,000. Then I have to figure out how I'm going to make a 500,000. And then if I build a product that can only make 500,000, because there's markets have cap, but that's okay. Maybe I build a SaaS and in a product that's so niche down that big people don't want to compete with me because there's no way I'm going to ever make more than $5 million or more than $500,000. But that's okay because it's less competition. You get out of the business and then you go to the next and to the next and to the next. Like, I'm a pilot. It's one of my hobbies. But I can fly little airplanes. You put me in a real big airplane that transport people around the ocean and I'm going to die, kill everyone on the board in like 10 seconds. You know, but you put in my little airplane that you can put four people on it and nobody's going to die. You're going to be just fine. And then that's how every pilot start. Like every professional pilot that's flying huge airplanes, they start flying little airplanes. But for whatever reasons, entrepreneurs think they can start at the end. You know, that's not where you start. So there's nothing wrong with your huge goal, but the problem is like, not understanding where you are and how you're going to be, you know, like, and if you grew up with parents that have money, and they can help you get started and you saw them run your business, your starting point's going to be different. You know, like, let's think about, like, he's controversial, but let's think about Trump. He started in a different place. His father gave him $1 million to start. So like, if you're not starting where he is, you have to figure out how to get there and then to go from other places. And that's why the son of like the high middle class is usually the people that become super rich. It's you have different starting points. You know, Bill Gates, he grew up pretty wealthy and that's why he became Bill Gates, because you start at different points. You have to know where you are. You can have big goals, but you have to be like, goals that cannot be achievable is just like dreams, you know? So you need to figure out how to make the next step and not try to start at the end. That's how I think about goals.
I love that. I need a reminder of that consistently because I tend to be big picture whenever it comes to things. And like, I always call it like macro micro, right? So like in every single situation, and you can take it down to like a product level and a business level. And you can also, you know, expand and think about it from like a life level, but I'm always thinking about the macro micro. And so like on a macro scale, what does this look like? And then on a micro scale, what does this look like? And I actually think that you're right. There's so much more value, sitting in that micro scale. Macro is good to paint the picture, to ask yourself, okay, where do I want to go? Like, what is the direction? Because that's really all you need in the beginning is, what is my direction? What is like my North Star? And then how is it that I can get close enough to over there, right? You were talking about how in the beginning, whenever you start to talk to people about their products, you set 90-day, I believe it was, 90-day mm-hmm. goals. You're like, okay, this is where we want to be in 90 days. And like, that's the perfect, I think, amount to, if you were just to sprint for 90 days, like you set a goal, you sprint for 90 days, you can get very, very far. And then you're closer and then you can see more of the goal.
Mm-hmm. And as you get getting closer and closer for your goal, then you're like, maybe going to change. Maybe you really didn't want that, you know, and then you can keep adjusting and figure out where you really want to be, because we keep changing, we keep developing.
Do you ever find it that people are afraid to make a decision with their SaaS that could potentially, like, they have to make a decision, they're not sure what decision to make because there's, like, not necessarily that there's, well, I guess in SaaS there's always potential upside and downside, but there's potential upside and downside to both. How do you see that good decision makers make those decisions where they're not sure whether to turn left or right?
The only way to get good at anything, and I think especially being a good decision maker, you make a bunch of bad decisions and then you start making good ones. You just try not to die in the way, you know, like try to make decisions that if everything goes wrong, you're going to still be alive to make a next decision. That's how you should think, how I think about making decisions. If I am wrong, I'm going to be able to be to a point where I can make the next one, because trying not to be wrong, it's just not going to work. Like, we're wrong most of the time. I was listening to Warren Buffett, and he talks about how he picks investments, and it's 10% of his picks along his career that make him the most successful investors. So he was wrong 90% of the time. You know, 90%, maybe not wrong. He didn't make the best decision he could have made. So to get good at make decisions, you just have to keep making decisions, and you just, again, look at your odds and put them in your favor, and try to make decisions that's not going to be, the output's not going to be take you out of business, or that not going to be able to make another decision again.
Interesting. That's also very in line with something Charlie Munger says, which is along the lines of compounding. Like, both Munger and Warren Buffett were very deliberate about how they compounded their wealth. You know, it was kind of like a boring way to create wealth. Whereas you see all of these people that are building all of these cool companies, and they're building their wealth in certain ways. But like Munger and Buffett, the two richest men on earth, like they built their wealth in a very, very boring, quote unquote, way. And I think that's really, well, I guess it speaks to the value of doing the boring things sometimes. Like, it's okay if there's not, you know, if you're not chasing the next shiny object. It's okay if you don't yet integrate AI or like do the next big thing and fall in line with all the trends, if what you are doing is making it unreasonable that you on your track do not get success.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many boring products we built that make $8 figures in revenue. You know, like they're never going to be in the cover of any huge magazine. They're never going to be amazing, but it's just like this one boring problem that no one is solving, and I want to solve that problem. You know, like, for example, we built a product to help people figure out how much inventory they have to buy for their Amazon stores. Kind of boring problem to solve, and he solved it, and he sold that company, and he's retired. so it is like, I also think there's a lot of money to be made when you're just willing to be boring. And it's go back to also think about tech stack. So many times people are trying to, what is the newest thing? I wanted to build with the coolest thing that's out there. And then you look at the products that are very successful, and they were built on top of like very boring stuff.
What is nobody going to get rid of? Excel. Nobody's getting rid of Google Drive. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I believe that's amazing. Like, you really have to think about, there's a lot of money to be made when you're following the boring stuff.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So to bring that, I guess, back to, you know, where a lot of people are on this podcast, a lot of the listeners are either trying to figure out what they're doing next, or they're just getting into SaaS or trying to break into SaaS. And I think that the concept of doing the boring things, like, that is understated. Either getting into a position where you are doing a lot of manual tasks and you're not so excited about all of the things you're doing, or I heard somebody call it carrying your water bucket, where it's like, in the beginning, everybody does the boring things, and then it opens up the opportunity for them to do the not boring things. But you have to endure the boring things to start. Do you have any tips or pieces of advice for people that are going through that season of like, I'm not doing what I love yet. I want to be at a higher level, but I'm just enduring.
Yeah, I think it goes a lot to what we were talking through the whole conversation in the show about thinking in smaller, like things that, like, just be more goal oriented. Like, what can I do in the next 90 days? Or what is, just if I find a boring problem to solve, it doesn't mean I'm going to solve that problem the rest of my life. You know, like, maybe I'm going to build a SaaS product in an industry that it's very underserved. I don't know, like maybe I'm going to help long companies schedule their appointments and go long for people's homes. But that doesn't have to be the problem that you're always going to solve. You solve that problem, you sell that SaaS, and you move on. And now you learn a lot, and then you can solve like a problem that you might find cooler, you know? So yeah, I think that's what sometimes you don't understand. Like, just because you're solving a boring problem, it's not going to be the thing they're going to do forever. And you also have to find joy in wherever you are, because it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. So
love that quote. I also think that the other thing you made me think about was, it's not necessarily that problems are boring. Maybe you just don't understand them, right? Because what the company that you mentioned that solves the problem for Amazon inventory, I think that that is a huge problem. And it's actually really fascinating because of how many other things it touches. Like, I imagine without that problem being solved, there are a lot of things in that whole Amazon process that'll break. And that, like, the fact that you get to solve a problem, that's really, really important. And if you really think about it, like, every single thing that we do is just solving problems. So if you work for somebody, you're solving a problem for them. And if you start to think about what you do in terms of the problems that you solve, I think that that's also a really, really interesting way to orient yourself toward being that, going back to the very, very beginning, but like the product level thinker. Like, if you start thinking in terms of all of the problems that you're solving, what problems am I solving for the people that I'm working for? What problems are we solving for the people that are our customers? What problems am I solving for, you know, just like breaking all of those problems that you're solving down and actually identifying the root cause problems. Like, I imagine that that's also a really good way to train your mind to start thinking about seeing problems.
For sure. And you get to a point where, like, I had so many ideas for SaaS products and I start many of them and they're like, oh, okay, that's not going to go anywhere. But that's all part of the process. You like start seeing problems and then you start thinking, okay, I'm going to solve this problem. And then you start like, oh, I guess I didn't understand everything I'm supposed to. But then you have other ideas and it's a good way to be thinking about, problems and how they could be solved through software, through service, to process. And it's just great to think about it. Like, for example, like I was working with this guy or speaking with this guy, whatever. And he saw the restaurants. They now get a lot of business because of DoorDash, Grubhub, Uber Eats. The problem is each of those companies wanted to put a tablet in your restaurant. So now restaurants have 10 tablets to be looking at what's going on. And then all those things have an open API. So he built one solution that brings all your orders in one. And it's, again, it's a simple problem, but he solved it. The restaurants bought it. And it's simple things like that.
I like that. Really quick before I get to my last questions, my rapid fire questions. How many ideas do you have that you actually start?
So I think I started a good 7 SaaS products before this one now that's doing well, that I'm close to PMF. But I have
whenever you start, are you just like focusing in and you're like, this is the only thing that I'm touching? Because I know that a lot of founders, like, they'll start 5 things at once or they'll start 3 things at once.
I try to do one at a time, but yeah, I see founders that they do a bunch of stuff, and it's a problem with like us entrepreneurs, because you always have a lot of ideas and then it's hard to focus. But I think that's important, to focus on something for a little bit and then you move to the next one.
So how do you I guess temper your shiny object syndrome?
I just try to stay busy or to do things outside of work that are fun and that gets me moving. Like, that's why I got into flying. It was better to go learn to fly airplanes than to start another business. It was even cheaper. But that's definitely a problem that I feel like a lot of my entrepreneur friends have. It's like how not to keep running after the next shine object. And you have to develop discipline, do a couple of times and lose time and money, and then you start getting better at or not.
Definitely some people that do not, but all right, I'm going to grab my, I have a list of questions that I always ask and I forgot to bring it. Okay. I'm back. Let's see. Mm-hmm. So these are the questions that I always ask everybody. And I ask them because I'm very intrigued to hear the diverse thoughts on these, or the diverse answers of these questions. Are you ready for the rapid fire questions?
I'm ready. I think.
Maybe. Number one, what is the biggest challenge that you've faced while working in SaaS?
It's being able to prioritize what to do next. There's always more to do than what we can do.
How do you deal with that?
There's many ways, but I love the now next later framework. It helps a lot.
I like that. Okay, the second question. You know the 80-20 Pareto principle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What 20% accounts for 80% of your success?
Okay. I think it's the knowledge of my industry and it's the knowledge of my industry.
Yeah, I like that. Very, very product oriented. I like it. The third question, what do you wish that you knew before you started?
I wish I knew that it would take longer and be harder than what I thought. We're always over optimistic. It helps you. I guess that's why you get going, because you're naive. I feel like naiveness helps us a lot. But I wish I knew how complex it is to make things work.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
Especially because of how my first business was super successful out of luck. I thought I would always be like that.
And then you had to learn. But the good thing is that through the learning, you have some knowledge and expertise that very, very, very few people have, which makes mm-hmm. you in a really good position.
Mm-hmm.
The last question that I have is actually a question. So I always ask my guests to give me one question that they would like me to ask the next guest. And my previous guest wanted me to ask you, is your current journey or path going to lead to a fulfilling life for you? It's a big one.
I think so. But that's why I'm more focused on building a lifestyle business than on building a huge business, because the reason we make money and the reason we build businesses so we can have better lives. So I feel like sometimes we lose track of what's the reason that I'm doing what I'm doing, and then we keep 100% working 100 hours a week and stuff. So I done that, been there, and I'm not doing anymore because I'm in a different place in my career, and that helps me find fulfillment in many ways.
That was phenomenal. Oh my gosh. Well, thank you so, so much. This has been amazing.